Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. April is National Poetry Month. Between now and the end of the month, we'll feature poets and their poems on the show. But to start things off, we thought that we should start at the top.
Juan Felipe Herrera is at the poetical top. He is the current Poet Laureate of the United States.
The son of migrant farm workers in California, Herrera grew up bilingual. His work crosses boundaries of all kinds, from describing the immigrant experience to taking the words off the page and creating performance art.
Herrera was in Milwaukee at the end of February to speak at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and he stopped by the studio then to talk with us as well. Juan Felipe Herrera, it is such a pleasure and an honor to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
In your poem, Let Me Tell You What a Poem Does, you write a wonderful stanza. And that is, a poem, of course, is always open for business, too, except, as you can see, it isn't exactly business that pulls your spirit into the alarming waters. So my first question to you is, when did your spirit first get pulled into those alarming waters?
Well, you know, my spirit got pulled into those alarming waters when I was born. I was born a Caesarean. Back in 1948 in a small town in the Central Valley of California, San Joaquin Valley. My mother was a farm worker, my father the same. So we just literally stopped in a town that my parents had been there before. Found that out recently. I have family roots in Fowler, California as workers, seasonal workers. So those were kind of alarming waters because I know it was very painful for my mother. The kind of medicines they had in those days were raw medicines and procedures were raw. And then growing up, speaking Spanish only and jumping into an English-only world in school. But then the alarming waters also can calm down. And I had an amazing mother and father and teachers. If it wasn't for a number of my teachers, it would have been more difficult for me. For poetry, my mother was always singing. And she always had a great mega desire to be an actress and dancer, a stage woman, you know, commanding the stage and really bloating with her beautiful heart, let her heart come out. And, you know, that duende, she had a lot of duende, that fire inside. So she passed that fire on to me. And so that's my poetry, where I pick it up, the heart of it, the root of it. The hot coals of it, and then beyond that were a lot of my wanderings through the civil rights movement of the late 60s and experiments. Everything was an experiment, as you know, in the late 60s. Everything was an experiment. Nothing was a given because the idea was to recreate everything. We're not going to pick up an old form or tradition. We're going to make the experimental attempt to recreate everything, how we dressed, how we sang, what we did, how we lived, what we wrote, how we wrote, who we wrote for, and why we wrote. All that was a new thing, especially for the Chicano and Chicana writers and poets and performers and dancers and singers and activists. Those were all one thing. They weren't one thing. If you were an activist, you were a poet. If you were a poet, you were doing street theater. If you were doing street theater, you were singing. And if you were singing, you were playing a guitar. And if you were playing a guitar, you were writing a script right on the spot. If you were writing a script right on the spot, you had a can of tuna and a can of tuna fish and a box of saltine crackers as you drove your Mustang, your beat-up Mustang, to the next gig and across the border into Mexico and then back. So that was kind of part of the gamut of things. And all along, you were doing this for as many communities as possible, for the Mexicano, Latino, Latin American, indigenous community, the student community, for women, and on, you know. So those were the platforms for me as a poet during those years for a couple of decades.
It sounds wonderful. Can we do it now?
We can do it now.
Yeah. It sounds fantastic. That idea of the rebirth of everything new, of everything kind of finding a new way to be in the world.
That's exactly what it was, a new way to be in the world. My home was a very quiet home. It was a very beautiful home, living in apartments and sofas and one-room houses. and my father's trailer he made out of whatever he could find, and on top of a car that he found also, and pulled by an army truck that he bought at an auction at Fort Bliss, El Paso. So my father, started this whole thing in a way of putting things together that generally wouldn't be put together, and making things out of found materials, and having no compunction about it. I'm gonna see that beat up car right there. Well, I'm gonna just dig it out, and clean it up, and maybe saw some of it off, and use it as a platform for a house that I'm gonna build on top, and I'll do that. And then we'll pull it with my army truck, and we'll go to the next town. Okay.
And is that how you approach poetry too? Kind of pulling and sawing and chopping and placing and.
That's exactly how I write. And you're right. When I was a kid, I would just walk through the libraries and just at kind of medium speed, and in terms of the stacks and the library. Book shelves, and I would just look at the book titles of books in the poetry section, and I would see the books pass by almost like a fast set of video clips, and I would see little black titles and green titles and yellow letters, and that in itself was very, very mesmerizing. And then I would pull out some books. I wasn't looking for anything because I didn't know how to really check books out, and I didn't think about doing that. I was just interested in the book covers and in the titles and what they look like. I didn't even open the book. And then I would open the books and look at what it was saying and who it was. And then I got really moved by that. And that's how I always, so then I would just pick up books like that. And so that's how I would start reading poetry. And sometimes my friends, this is the late 60s, they'd be talking about Boris Pasternak, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Friedrich Nietzsche. And, on and on with the poets, Federico Garcia Lorca. And my friends, some of them were older, most of them were older than me, the ones that talked like that. So I would just bum around with them, I would just be bumming around with them. And I never was in the big conversation because they were like the leaders of those conversations. But I was in the vicinity of the group.
Absorbing.
I was absorbing everything.
Now, were you always writing in English to start, or did you write in Spanish first since it was your first language?
I don't know which one was first. It was probably English because I was in school, elementary, middle school, and high school. So because some of my teachers were really fun. Mr. Warner in eighth grade says, well, students, I want you to, when you write your book report, I don't want to hear sentences that start in 1776, blah, 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 happened. I want to see the clouds were quiescent in 1776. And then he wanted us to go on, just move it around and jumble up the syntax and then say what you got to say. So that's when my light bulb went on again. It had gone on in third grade with Mrs. Sampson. She called me up to sing in front of class. And I just met her recently, in June, last June. She's 95, was my third grade teacher in the 1956. And she's the one who invited me to speak and sing in front of class and had me singing a solo at the end of the year in front of the whole school assembly. But I was in the opposite world. I wasn't a speaker or a writer or a person who had conversations or was active or had even made myself present in any way. I was a silent, quiet, invisible boy at the very end or back of that classroom in any position, anywhere in school, anywhere in any way you could imagine where students are, cafeterias, school grounds. I was the same way. I wasn't involved in anything.
But I think that kind of quietness and sitting in the back allows you to see everything.
Yeah.
And I wonder how, if that fed your poetry, the fact that you could be back there observing and watching and absorbing.
Of course. See, that's, I'm blessed to have both worlds, to be an invisible observer and to be right in the middle of the volcano. And both are important. You're right. I hadn't thought of it like that. You're right. I love to just kind of wander around like a goldfish in the torrents and waves of what's going on. That's right, and it's required for poetry. It's one of the requirements. It really does involve a lot of time out and time in. Something like a deep observation and deep listening, somewhere around there, and considering things along the way. Because if we don't, we're going to just pass everything up and only pay attention to those things we feel we're supposed to pay attention to, when in fact there's gazillions of things that already took place in front of us, and we never even noticed them. And those things are the ones that the poet survives on, those things that no one else notices. And we all do, but the poet takes extra time.
Now, do you get the opportunity, being the Poet Laureate of the United States, do you get the chance for that deep listening and that quiet time? Or are you pretty much out in public now having to do the outward part of your job as a poet?
That's right. I have to do the outward part, and it's a very big outward part. But the time that I do get is two great places, the airport and being inside that 31,000 foot above sea level jet going at I don't know how many hundreds of miles per hour. And, you know, it's a perfect place to be too, right? Because you're bundled in, you can't move, and there's only one thing you can do is sleep, stare, or write. And so I go with the writing. So I write a lot in airports. I catch up with everything. Well, I hope I do. So,
well, it's also a perfect place to sit and observe.
It's a perfect place to sit, observe, and actually have some wild conversations.
I bet.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with an Indian woman. So I asked her, so what's going on with, you know, with iPhones and new technology? How do you see that? And she says, we're becoming a new species. I go, what? What do you mean a new species? She goes, yes. Everybody walks around with their arm in front of them looking at a tablet or a smartphone. And it's like a new limb. It's the third arm. Oh, I said.
And she's right.
Yeah.
I really do think we're going to end up
with a third limb.
With a third limb.
Yeah.
It's going to be attached permanently.
It's going to be attached. Yeah. It's going to come out of the hand or something.
Or it's going to be part of the palm. And I use my smartphone all the time. But there are many times, particularly when I'm traveling, I try to put it down because I don't want to experience the world through the phone.
Yeah.
I want to actually see the world. Yes. I actually want to, like, make eye contact.
Seeing the world.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. Seeing the world, you know, we miss. Well, you know, what's interesting, you're right. Because everybody, like you say, everybody walks down the street and with a third hand. And we no longer walk around the street, you know, gawking at each other or having these immense conversations in cafes. Even in cafes, we sit down and we look down. Our head goes down, our arm comes up, and the machine's there. And we're communicating. But we're talking and we're communicating. But it's a whole different style.
And so the poetry is going to change, too.
The poetry changes. Yeah, that's a new one. That's a good one. It has to.
It has to.
It has to.
Yeah.
It has to. You know, the audiences are bigger. That's an odd change. That's an odd change. We would think that they're smaller, but they're bigger. Schools have poetry clubs. There's national spoken word championships. There's poetry out loud across almost every state in the United States. Even small books are still happening. You know, small editions are still happening. So the spoken word world is very strong.
Maybe in reaction to all of that.
Maybe.
I often wonder, because we need that connection.
We need that connection. And maybe it's only, I'm trying to put things together. I guess it's still so dynamic, I can't put it into words. You know, I get called on to, I was at the Boston University to do the keynote for Martin Luther King Day. And I found that most interesting. Because I'm a poet. So how come I would be doing the keynote? It didn't sound like a poet invitation to me. It sounded more like a speaker invitation to me or an invitation for a poet to be the speaker. So I found that beautiful. And I found that great because as a Chicano, I was invited to Boston University on a holiday or an occasion on Martin Luther King, an African-American figure and hero and pioneer and civil rights leader. And I found that excellent. And it points to the fact that we can come together, not only among our own groups, but beyond that, And we've always talked about it, but we do it rarely, which is odd.
It's harder to do than it is to talk about.
It's harder to do than to talk about it. And maybe through through creativity, we can cut across boundaries.
Do you think poetry does that better than any other written form? Do you think poetry can cross those boundaries in a way that other prose forms can't?
Poetry can cut across boundaries. You know, writing has always been a total experience. What we call poetry has always been a total experience, but it's changed, of course. It became kind of, kind of commodified, kind of bookified. It got bookified, and it got qualified. So we have to know this and know that and read this and take that and qualify through here and get this piece of paper until we make it to poetry land, when in fact it's the most accessible thing. For example, in indigenous villages and communities, I think everyone's a poet because there's no really word for a poet. There's no word for art. And it really, what it ends up being is like the visions of a number of people in the community that then are shared and benefit for that community. What are the crops going to be like that year? What is the health of the community? What must be done? And also venerating the ancestors in a circle outside with everyone involved. So that's the poetry. And it has stories to it, and it has songs in it, and it has drumming in it, and it has dancing in it, and it has the elements of the day and night in it, and it has kind of a continuous cycle of fasting and observations and little chicken sacrifices and little tortillas and corn that gets harvested for the first time and little rock churches. We would call them a church. It's like a hut made out of rocks and twigs, and people are intensely pray in that space, and all of it goes together. And that's all of that, plus what people wear and who they are and the mountain itself, if it's on top of a mountain in central Mexico. So that would be the poem, but it's a whole different kind of poem.
It's life.
By the way, yeah, it's life. I forgot. Yeah. You're right. It's life.
Would you leave us with a poem?
Well, I'm going to, if I can, I'm going to see if I can read this scribbled poem.
So this is new.
This is new. I don't even know if I can read it because I don't know where it ends. So
kind of like life.
It's kind of like, you know, life keeps on busting in on us. Why is that, huh?
I don't know.
So let's create a title. And let's say the title for this poem is "They Said They Wanted to Build a Beautiful Wall." Let's say that's the title. They said they wanted to build a beautiful wall. A wall that could not speak. And a wall tall, prepared, propped up next to the dark mountain of guards and sentries. No one would ever cross it. No one would ever cross it or touch it or conquer it. There it was, the beautiful wall, burning with the reflections of million faces that peered upon it every day. The wall was a burning wall with so many voices traveling through and spirits smoothing around it and bones knocking upon it and rain talking to it in a language it could not understand. It was the rain from the faces. It was the rain from the faces.
Juan Felipe Herrera, thank you so much. That was just beautiful.
Thank you. I gave it my best.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Juan Felipe Herrera is the Poet Laureate of the United States. He was in Milwaukee in February to speak at UWM. The brand new poem that he read for us is called "They Said They Wanted to Build a Beautiful Wall."